From 1971 to 2001, over 250,000 children were adopted from outside the United States, over half of them from Asia, and 19% from the next most popular continent, Europe. At the same time, according to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, over 523,000 children were living within the U.S. foster care system in 2003. 35% of those were non-Hispanic black, 39% were non-Hispanic white, 17% were Hispanic, 1% were Asian, and 2% were American Indian. The majority of families that adopt from abroad are white. And considering the steep costs of transnational adoption, which can range into the tens of thousands of dollars, most are middle class or above. Transnational adoption began in the U.S. in substantial numbers in the 1950s. One organization that played a significant role in this development has been the Holt International Adoption Agency, based in Eugene, Oregon. Susan Cox, Vice President of Public Policy and Advocacy for Holt, elaborates on the different factors that go into people's decisions to adopt.
On a humanitarian level, for many people, compelling to think that children in other countries without families very much need intercountry adoption to have a family. And I think for many people that that's also a strong motivation.
As for how Holt chooses which countries it will work in, Cox explains,
certainly, adoption is a business, but we try very hard to make sure that the humanitarian and the humanity and the respect of the process is also paramount. The reason that we go into a particular country or how we determine what countries we will go in is certainly the need. We look at countries in association with what is the atmosphere, what are the circumstances for children, what are the laws and policies around that country, what are the resources, is there an organization or individual in that country that will help us establish a program. Intercountry adoption is not always the appropriate response for children in a country.
Transnational and transracial adoption is not without its controversies. In the worst-case scenario, questions about birth mother's consent and illegal baby trade practices have certainly been cause for concern. But even with legal adoption and informed consent, questions emerge about why pipelines develop for adopting children from particular countries. Crystal Williams, poet and professor at Columbia College in Chicago, was adopted as an infant by an African-American father and white mother. She offers her perspective on transnational and transracial adoption as an African-American adoptee.
There are some people who do it because they believe that all children are equal. Political statements run deeply beneath their motives. And who am I to question them? If it's a white family who's adopted a black child, it's complicated because I would rather a black child, or actually I would rather any child, but I would rather a black child be in a home in which they are loved and loved deeply as I have been than in a foster system.
She also questions why so many children are adopted from Asian countries while so many children of color go unadopted within the U.S.
More traditional is for white families to adopt Asian babies. Listen, black lives are not valued in this country equally to white lives. That's a fact. Black people are not considered as bright as white people. That's a fact. So it doesn't surprise me. No. It's to be expected that a black child would not be as desirable as a child from some other country. People in the country, in this country, don't want to deal with race. They never have, and we have never really dealt with it. And so I can imagine that raising a black child would mean at some point that you're going to have to deal with race. So why would you bring a conversation that you don't really want to have into your house and raise it for 18 years? They don't think that they have to have the conversation with Asian babies. Asian babies are white to them. They just are kind of exotic.
Circumstances surrounding why children are given up for adoption in the first place vary. Poet Casey Kwong from Ashland, Oregon, was adopted from Korea at age 4 with his 6-year-old brother and raised in Medford, Oregon. He explains,
my mom divorced my father in the 70s, which was unheard of in Korea, and with 3 sons. So when she did, my father kind of dropped out of the scene. He disappeared and left my mom with 3 boys to raise. And a woman in the 70s didn't work outside of the house. There's not a lot of jobs. in Korea for women except for maybe working at a church or an orphanage. So she did what she could for as long as she could, and then she got sick. She worked at an orphanage until she got sick, and then she just couldn't do it anymore. So my brother and I were sent to America. My oldest brother was too old to be adopted and was sent to the army. And yeah, that's what happened.
For adoptees, adjusting to their new homes is not always easy.
It's a huge trauma. You're pulled out of your country. You're separated from your family. You don't even get to eat the food that you're used to eating. And so you have to cope with that.
Both Casey Kwong and Crystal Williams point to the tensions between racial identity and cultural identity in the U.S., an issue that resonates with many, adopted or not.
The thing is, when I go to Korea, I just don't feel Korean. I don't speak the language. I don't know the customs. I don't know the etiquette. But I was born in Korea. I did live there for 4 years. That is my bloodline. I am Korean.
I don't know. I just was raised black. There was never any question about whether or not I was black or not. And I don't know that there would have been any question about whether I was black or not had my mom been a biological mother. But I didn't feel as if I was steeped in a kind of black cultural tradition. And I have not been steeped in a traditional black cultural tradition. I never was, and I never have been. So what I really hope for is that people give their children the tools, the kind of emotional and psychological tools that they'll need to deal with the questions of identity that they're going to face.
At the same time, there is no uniform response to the adoption experience. Kwong recalls how he and his brother reacted differently to their circumstances.
The ways that my brother and I coped with that were very different. I chose to forget. I don't know if I chose it, that's just what happened. I forgot. And I just created this whole nother identity. I reinvented myself. Well, my brother didn't. His survival depended on remembering.
That remembering included their oldest brother, whom they left behind in Korea.
We had a really strong bond with him because while my mom was at work, he was pretty much raising us. So Chris, who was adopted with me, never forgot about him. And so he wanted to go and find him. I had the luxury of forgetting. My brother's stance is that he does remember it, and his survival depends on that memory, on remembering where he comes from. And that's what drove him and us to go back and find our brother, because he knew all along, he knew the whole time, and he needed some proof what he remembered was true.
At 19, Kwong was able to return to Korea with his brother and was reunited with his birth mother and oldest brother. They've been in touch ever since.